Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at your garden. It's another edition of Garden Talk. We're going to deal a bit with soil today and composting because Kevin Shesho is our guest. Kevin is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And he has a special interest in soil ecology and composting. He has both an MS and BS in soil science from the UW-Madison and from UW-River Falls. And he also recently was presented with the Bronze Award from the Wisconsin Garden Club Federation. Kevin, congratulations and welcome back to Garden Talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Larry. It's always good to be back.
Oh, it's always great to have you with us. And I know we want to talk about soil and composting, and we'll get on, but we'll also talk plants as well. I want to invite our listeners to join us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Sometimes I had, when I was a student here, the students would, for soil science classes, they'd often say, well, I've got a dirt class. And, of course, the professors hated that. Well, if you're going to talk about what is soil?
Well, you're right, Larry. I think some of us that are advocates for the soil, you know, I don't say get offended by calling it dirt, but I appreciate the fact that people, you know, call it whatever because it is so important for growing our plants and feeding the, you know, masses and all of our agriculture. But soil is, I think, a very complex media. It's got both biology happening. There's physical properties and chemical properties that all make up that wonderful media that sustains life on the planet. It filters our water. It supplies, you know, all the things we need to survive.
And right.
It's just one of those underappreciated resources. Obviously, our listeners today are gardeners and have that interest in gardening, so they, I think, value it considerably more than maybe the average person. But, yeah, it's sometimes forgotten, and we walk on it every day. We drive by it. It's around us. It protects the soil from erosion. Plants protect the soil from erosion. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that soil does for us.
And we had a broad range of soils here in Wisconsin. I was talking with our producer, my producer, Cheyenne Lentz, before the show, and letting her know that the state soil is Antigo silt loam.
That's true. It's a bit of trivia that, you know, the average person probably doesn't know. But we do have an official state soil. Francis Hole, who is a professor of soil science at UW-Madison, championed that back in the early 80s and designated that the Antigo silt loam is our official state soil. So add that to your knowledge of Wisconsin trivia.
Well, it's a great to have a chance to talk with you. And I think one of the, you know, this time of year, it's kind of interesting taking a look at our plants. Do we think about soil testing at this time of year at all?
Well, I think any time we take the time to investigate our soil, and certainly doing a soil test and getting it analyzed for those nutrients, and that's more that chemical piece of soil quality and soil health. You know, you can do that anytime. Typically, we do it in the spring or in the fall after the growing season or before it because nutrients have been removed and cycled through, and we can kind of start the gardening season fresh with new information. But, you know, there's nothing wrong with taking a soil sample this time of year if you're so inclined to do that. But typically, we do that in the spring and fall. But the things we can do right now to investigate the quality and the health of our soil this time of year is we're right in the middle of the growing season, and there's all kinds of biology that's going to be happening out in the soil. We can observe the plants that are growing in our soils, and that's something that we can't do as easily in the fall.
Sure.
When most of the plants are dormant or have died, or in the spring, or if the ground is frozen. But now our soils are teeming with life, and they're doing, you know, they're at their maximum kind of production, and the ecology is just going crazy right now. So now is a really good time to, you know, to investigate some of those biological and physical properties that make up a healthy soil. So I always encourage people to, you know, dig in the dirt, if you want to say that, and get their hands dirty and smell the soil. And those are all indications of how the soil quality is. And just an aside to that, when I said the smell of the soil, that is associated with a microorganism called an actinomycete. And that is a very important a microorganism that helps in decomposition and, you know, helps feed the soil. But it's also one of those very powerful antibiotics that kills other bad bacteria and other microorganisms. And actually, that's where some of our medical antibiotics came from, from the soil.
Is that right? I did not know that. Mm-hmm. Well, what is soil supposed to smell like?
Well, some people say it smells, you know, earthy and fresh, and I mean, it doesn't obviously have an offensive smell. I guess, no. You know, it's all in the eye of the beholder, but certainly I think if you smell something that, you know, is more chemical, you know, overtones or rotten, you know, that's maybe not as appealing as something that's more, I don't know, say earthy. I guess that's mm-hmm. just a good way to describe it. And anybody who's really worked with a good, you know, tilth, you know, soft soil with lots of organic matter can kind of get a sense for that, or brings back those memories of, you know, working in the garden when you're younger and this is the first time you were exposed to some of those smells, you know, so.
I was having some good thoughts about that right now. And then, of course, I grew up on a farm, and so when we had fall plowing or spring plowing, sometimes the smell of that mm-hmm. soil was just overpoweringly good.
Yeah, and then, you know, sometimes those country smells, you know, manure, you know, sometimes people like that as a good, you know, positive thing to think about, because manure is good nutrients to add back to the soil, and we do that a lot in Wisconsin with our animal waste and put it on the land and, you know, put it to good work. So, yeah. Smell of manure can be good.
Let's take a call. Cheryl in Verona is online, so let's go to her. Cheryl, thanks a lot for calling. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call. Speaking of animal waste, this is perfect. I have my Lane chickens are out in the pasture. This is their third year. The first year they had really good grass. The second year it was not so good, and I reseeded it before I put them out there, and the only thing I got was moss. So I'm wondering what would I need to do to add into the soil when I till it up this fall to bring it back to a good pH. I guess that's probably what I'm thinking is the case.
Man,
with
I'm
all the chickens that are out there.
I'm really surprised it was moss. At least I am. Kevin, comment?
Yeah, I mean, moss is an indicator of the fact that the grass is not as happy and the moss outcompetes it. And so, you know, this is, and I've mentioned this concept before, you know, horticulture CSI, and trying to think about all the evidence and the pieces of the puzzle here is why isn't the grass doing as well as you'd like. And, you know, you indicated the pH, and sometimes pH is an indication that the plants aren't as happy. So by amending the soil with a lime, we can increase the pH and get it into that level that's more appropriate. So a soil test, certainly, if you haven't done it, could provide some of that information.
Okay.
You know, and maybe the chickens, and I don't know how densely the grass was grazed or how much you know, detriment, if you will, the chickens did in scratching and removing that existing turf, but it could be that it was maybe overgrazed. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's possible. So do you think a soil test is really the best thing then to tell me if it's like too much nitrogen from the chicken's waste or...
Well, that's, a soil test is a point in time. So if you took that soil test today, you'll get, you know, I always say don't guess, take the test.
Okay.
It costs about $15 to plus a little shipping to do that. But you have a baseline information on where your soil is right now. And perhaps, you know, with that soil test, you'll find something revealing, and maybe it is the pH. But when we get into nitrogen, you know, chickens have a very high concentration of ammonia in their, you know, in their feces.
Uh-huh.
And perhaps that overloaded the system a little bit, and that's part of the problem. We like to rotate our animals across the landscape if we can. So I don't know if you have a chicken tractor or have that ability to move them around, but that way they're not concentrating.
Yep, they're in a different pasture now. So what I wanted to do was to try to mend this pasture so it's ready for next year.
And sure, and be sure to tell, report what you're planning for the soil where you have the soil test, and that that always helps them.
Right. Okay, on the soil test information sheet, you put down what you want to do, and they'll give you the recommendation. So I'd start there and then, you know, follow the recommendations of reseeding. Fall is a really good time. Late summer, early fall is a really good time to establish our cool season grasses.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks, Cheryl, for calling. Appreciate the call. Talking today with Kevin Shesho, who is the Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. He knows a whole lot about soil, but a whole lot about plants in general, and I'm certainly inviting you to join in with your questions and comments on this edition of Garden Talk. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post on our Facebook page, title, The Larry Mealer Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Kevin, we unfortunately, there was a recent report of late blight in central Wisconsin. And maybe we should talk a little bit about this. What plants were affected?
And those of us in with University of Wisconsin Extension, we have a network of faculty and staff all across the state and our state specialists. So, we're always sharing information. And I recently got an email from my colleague in Portage County, Ken Schrader, and he just was alerting everybody that they have now confirmed three sightings or confirmations of late blight in the central part of the state. And I just wanted to make sure everybody was aware that it's been found and to alert our gardeners, because tomatoes and potatoes are very susceptible to this fungal disease. And, in Wisconsin, we have a substantial commercial potato industry. Wisconsin is third in the nation behind Idaho and Washington State in potato production. So it's pretty substantial industry in Wisconsin. And just letting, the homeowners and the gardeners know that late blight has been found and to keep an eye out for it. And this is the same disease that caused the Irish potato famine back in the 1800s. So we just wanted to make sure people are vigilant in looking and observing their plants. And unfortunately, once your plants get this, we really recommend destroying the entire plant, pulling it up, roots and all, putting in a plastic bag, solarizing it in the sun, and then basically pitching it, because the spores on this fungus spread quite readily. And, again, if we get this in our commercial potato fields, or even if you're a market gardener and you have a substantial amount of potatoes or tomatoes, late blight is a really tough disease to manage. So we just want to make sure people are aware of that and keep an eye out for it.
And, of course, it's right in the central part of the state where we have this huge potato production.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we got potatoes all over the state. And I was also told by Brian Huddleston, our disease diagnostic manager down at UW-Madison, that you can send samples into the disease diagnostic lab and just mention late blight analysis on those samples, and they'll do it for no charge.
And the signs for it...
you get these kind of olive brown to black, water-soaked, kind of oily areas on the leaves, and it causes the whole tissue to collapse. And it eventually the whole plant just kind of almost melts away. And it's a little different than some of our other more common blights on tomatoes, like septoria leaf spot or early blight. Those you typically get these lesions that have yellowing or halos around a dead spot on the tissue, or concentric little circles. So late blight is a little different than the fact that you get these black spots or lesions that just look oily and water soaked. So it's considerably different looking than our more common blights that are on tomatoes.
Kevin Shesho, our guest today on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk. Taking a look at your garden today, the flower garden, your vegetable garden, with Kevin Shesho, a UW Extension Ag Development Agent for Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for joining in. We've zeroed in a little on soil, but certainly talking about plants and diseases as well of all kinds. So don't be afraid to join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org, or again, post on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Daniel in Waniwak, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. I always wonder about no-air composting. When you make a compost pile, cover it with plastic, how long does that take, and does that heat up just like a regular compost pile?
So no air, you're deliberately making
that
pile?
Yeah, there's a name for it. There's okay. I should have looked up the name.
Okay. Typically, we want to encourage both, more aerobic decomposition than anaerobic, and once you seal off that pile to air exchange, it's going to go anaerobic, and there are certainly bacteria that will help in decomposing and turning that organic material into compost, but it's not the preferred method of composting in an anaerobic situation. That's more of the biodigester kinds of systems that are using that approach. So in the backyard, I still like to advocate just, leaving it open. Obviously, you got to keep it covered so that critters can't get in there. But I'm not familiar with, I guess a concept of no-air composting.
No, I guess I'm not either.
But you just have to keep in mind there's all that soil bacteria or the compost food web has certain requirements to thrive and to break down all those organic materials, and oxygen for most of them is very critical in producing good quality compost.
Yeah. Thanks, Daniel, for calling. Carolyn in Wauwatosa, it's your turn. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. My name is Caroline. I have a question for Kevin. I'm in the process of converting my front yard into food and flowers, so no grass. And so I, started planting some things, some flowers, and I also have some vegetable plants in there. But and I know he's going to tell me to get a soil test, and that's on my list. But are there any other things that I can do to amend that soil? Prior to this, we had an apple tree in the front, but that came down last year. So when the tree was there, I kept adding compost, to that area. So it's not completely, hungry or whatever.
Barren.
Sure. So what's covering the soil surface in general right now? Is it still got a fairly dense sod cover, or what's the existing vegetation like?
Well, with the apple tree was really large. Our Wauwatosa yards are really small. So the tree was covering a lot of the front yard. So the grass was not growing under there. I mean, there were a bunch of dandelions and violets and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So that's what was growing.
Yeah, well, I would say that's probably, and now the tree is gone, and I suppose there's still some tree roots in there that are going to be decomposing over time, and that's not necessarily a bad thing. You might see some mushrooms associated with that, and I wouldn't be too concerned about those as they show up if they do. But for the most part, you're going to have yourself a really almost ideal starting situation for establishing some kind of edible landscape rather than the lawn. And I really applaud you for taking that approach, because I think we need to always think of ways to add diversity to our landscapes. And I'm not saying lawn is a bad thing to have. There's lots of people that enjoy it. But personally, I'd rather harvest vegetables and enjoy flowers in my front yard than mowing the grass. And actually, I do have vine crops growing in the front of our lawn at the moment. So I'm kind of giving that an experiment, see what the neighbors think of having a sprawling vine crops instead of mowed grass. But I would say, you know, when it comes to, you know, making that conversion, you know, you're right, soil test would be a nice thing to do. But if you have a way to just continue to mulch that area with any kind of organic material and plant right into that mulch, or plant your beds, make, you know, draw it out on a piece of paper and try to sketch out a little bit of a landscape design, if you will, how you might want your front area to look. That includes some of these different, you know, flowers and vegetables, you know, keeping in mind some of the requirements as far as full sun, or some can maybe take a little bit of shade. But if you're in a full sun environment, I mean, it's a painter's palette. You can put all kinds of different plant materials out there. And just start, you know, small and experiment. And but as far as enriching that soil, you know, if you've got materials to either just lay on the soil surface, they'll slowly decompose and feed the soil. You can plant right through those. You know, that's a really good way to smother weeds. That's that whole mulching concept. But I would use a mulch that's a little lower in the carbon. So leaves, shredded leaves, if you can find good quality compost, you can use, you know, use that as a mulch, or if you want to, you can use wood, but that just takes a little longer to decompose. So I don't know if that's helpful, but that's kind of one way to look at it.
So I'm going to ask you another question. I do have I've been composting for like 20 years. I've got a pile behind the garage, so it's not completely decomposed, but could I, if it's partially, would that would add, that'd be mulch, but also protect the soil. Could I put that down? Because eventually it's going to decompose.
You're right. Eventually it will. And it's, you know, it's all in how you, in perspective on you know, making compost. Another thing that I'm a big fan of is what we call leaf mold. And that's basically where you just collect your leaves in the fall. Yeah, if you can run them through a lawnmower and chop them up and make them a little smaller, so be it. But basically, you just put that in a big pile, maybe you fence it in some chicken wire or something, and then water it down. And that just kind of speeds up some of that decomposition. And, you know, after a couple of weeks or a month or two, you've got a partially decomposed material. It's not black and soft like finished compost, but it's been heated enough and it's partially decomposed. And now you can use that as a ground cover. So whether your compost is completely finished or not, I don't think matters so much. You know, we always have to, you know, caution, though, that if you have a lot of disease plant materials that go in a compost, having a nice hot composition, decomposition, a hot pile compost is better than one that maybe is, you know, not as active, because we always have to be concerned about spreading diseases back in the landscape if, you know, if those diseases are still present in the compost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There we go. Thanks,
Thank
Caroline.
Thank you so much. That's very helpful. So.
Yeah. Appreciate the call, Caroline. Thank you so much. And you can join in, too. Open lines at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Kate in Madison next. Hi, Kate.
Hi there. See, I've had sedums growing for most of my adult life, which is like 40-plus years. And this is the first year I've ever had anything attack them. And it's really hard. I just can't figure out what the heck it is. And some of my sedums are sitting there untouched, and then others, like I had to destroy a whole autumn joy because it was just covered. But the edges of the leaves are, they look like they've been chewed or eaten, not rabbit damage.
Mm-hmm.
And then it goes all along the trail of the sedum vine. And then after it looks like it's been eaten for a while, they're developing shallow grayish spots on the top of the leaf.
Okay.
I just don't have a clue what this is.
Yeah, so this gets back to that whole concept of, you know, horticulture CSI. You've got the crime scene. Mm-hmm. Something happened. Now we got to go back and do our investigation. So, you know, you've indicated that there's something going on with the leaves, the leaf edges. It just look like it's like chewing, and parts of the leaf margins have been removed.
It's very weird. It's a jagged edge, which I just, And it's not a bite. I know that. Mm-hmm. I've seen rabbit bites, and we don't have any deer in the area.
Okay.
I just don't have a clue.
Well, you know, I mean, there are possibly insects that, you know, will be out, you know, feeding on those. And anytime we see those kind of jagged edges, that's one thing we have to consider. Earwigs might be, climbing up there and causing some damage. And a lot of times we don't see the critter that's causing the problem, during the day because they feed at night. So, you know, you might want to take a peek at those plants in the dead of night, go out with a flashlight and see if you can't catch somebody in the act, so to speak. But insects might be a consideration here. When we have damage, that opens up the plant to other infections, other pathogens. So maybe that those sunken areas and the, might be a result of some diseases that have colonized on the leaf. And the weather we've been having has been very conducive for lots of different both fungal and bacterial diseases. So, you know, this year may be a little different in that regards from in the past. But I would just encourage you to if you got to get on your hands and knees and maybe dig around a little bit in the soil or in the mulch around the plants, try to look for a pattern. You know, if it is along just the edge, that tells us something too. Is there something unique about that environment? So I guess I would just encourage you to go back and look and see if you can identify whether it is indeed an insect, which I'm suspecting might be the case here, or, you know, it could be something else. So,
Insects are good. I think you've got an answer there, Kevin. I don't know. And Kate, take Kevin's advice. Take a look out there. And frankly, if you can't find anything, eventually, you could try sending something to the plant, the diagnostic clinic, and they could take a look at it and see what's going on. The plant disease diagnostic clinic, that'd be a guess. And oftentimes, if it looks like it was an insect, it'll go up to the insect diagnostic clinic as well, because it's right in the same building.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it's hard to make a diagnosis over the phone or over the radio like this without seeing pictures, and you can send pictures in to, local extension office there, Madison Dane County, of course. Lisa Johnson would be able to help with diagnosing some of that. We also have just launched off of our horticulture website with UW Extension, a horticulture inquiries page that allows people to log into that page, type in their question, their name, contact information, and the county that they're residing in, and that goes into the system and then is redirected back out to the appropriate contact people out in the state. So that's just another resource that just came online through our hort.uwex.edu website.
Yeah, that's a good website. Really good. Thanks a lot, Kate, for calling. Earl in Germantown, your turn. Hi, Earl.
Yes, thank you. About 7-8 years ago, we have a creek running by our subdivision here, and there's a lot of black raspberry bushes, okay? There's a power line adjacent to that, and the power company says, take those berries out of there, take those bushes out of there if you want. So I did. I transplanted some of those wild berry bushes, like I said, 7-8 years ago, and the yield was real phenomenal for the first couple of years. Just lately, though, the past couple of years, the berries have been very few and very small. And I'm just wondering if I have a cutback type problem with it, or that just they run out of steam, or what?
Yeah, blackberries are one of those. We have wonderful wild patches that, are just gems when you find them, because they can be as big as your thumb and just wonderful to go out and pick those wild ones. And that's really the best way to enjoy black raspberries in particular if you can. But when we transplant them, we're taking them out of that native environment. And you mentioned, it's probably very rich and organic maybe type soil, lots of moisture associated with that creek bottom. And then you move them. And so, you have to consider that change in environment. And you said, they did well for a couple of years. And I don't know if you're continuing to amend the soil with, you know, putting some mulch and organic materials around there to keep those roots cool and keep that soil enriched. Because, again, I think in nature, that's where they seem to do the best in those kind of environments. So that might be something, you know, that's going on as these berries get a little bit older. And, you know, plants don't always live indefinitely. They kind of, you know, send up new sprouts and suckers. And, you know, if they're not allowed to do that, the older plants might just start, you know, running out a little bit of juice, so to speak. But when you mention small berries, we also have to consider pollination and flowers and, you know, were the flowers properly pollinated. Sometimes we have weather in the spring that can influence, you know, the flower and how many of those little pistils and anthers, you know, and all that stuff that make the fruit. You know, if there was interference with that because of weather or frost, or maybe there wasn't a lot of pollinators around this year at the right time, that causes some of that too. So that would be my first inclination.
There we go.
What about cutting back on the new shoots that come up? Normally, those bushes have a tendency, the tips of the new shoots have a tendency to just wrap around and recede themselves, the tips of them, into the ground again. Should I cut those off?
Well, in more cultured practice, you know, when we talk about growing raspberries in, you know, in a garden situation, or certainly if you're a commercial, you know, grower, we have, you know, standard kind of recommendations for trellising and pruning and, you know, cutting back that, you know, that top growth, you know, about the top third of it is typically what we do in the spring, just to, you know, concentrate some of that energy and growth into the spurs and into the flower shoots, and keep it from getting all topsy-turvy and you know, flopping over. So I would say you could certainly, you know, do that with these as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling, Earl. Appreciate your call. We had an email question from Scott in Wisconsin Rapids. Is there a fungicide one could use for late blight on tomatoes?
And unfortunately, I don't have my website up right in front of me. But if you go online, and you know, depending if you have access to the internet, but just typed in, you know, late blight UWEX in a search box, you're going to get a number of resources that address this, you know, specific topic. But if I recall the fact sheet that Ken Schroeder had sent out and referenced, there are fungicides that, you know, will work. The challenge is there's different strains of this particular fungus, and some of the strains are more difficult to control with some of our more conventional fungicides. But if I recall, chlorothalonil, which is kind of our standard, you know, over-the-counter fungicide, is one that was mentioned. And then anything that contains copper, I think, is also going to be somewhat effective. But I would go online and check out some of those fact sheets. Amanda Gevins, who's our vegetable pathologist, is also on top of all this too, and there might be some references there. But anytime we're applying a fungicide, you just got to follow the label and, you know, directions and make sure you're applying it properly and all that. And there are some organic type of fungicides, I think, that you could try to protect your plants. But I would say, you know, culturally, make sure the plants are pruned back and you got some of the suckers removed on those tomatoes to let air flow through. And those are cultural things we can do before we even have to apply the fungicide. But I would, again, go online and check out those resources.
Rick in West Bend will turn to you next. Hi, Rick. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Using all your shows out there in the field and taking care of the forest and stuff, great stuff.
Oh my goodness, we lost him. Rick, we can't hear you. I'm sorry, you must be in a bad place. Maybe if you're in a car, call back. We'll try and get you a better line. Let's go to Pam and Kellogg next. Pam, hi.
Good morning. Several years ago, I had a strawberry garden, strawberry patch. This morning I just planted a new one. I was wondering if there's anything new from the way I used to do it. Now, before they said the first year you should pick off the blooms so the strength goes to the plant, not have any berries. And is that still true? And the other part was it's down in next to a hay field, and we have tons of field mice all winter, and I'm wondering, is there anything I can do to protect that? And it will need to be mulched, I presume, but then there's the mouse problem.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, it's, of course, there's always new things that, you know, that come out, and maybe some new varieties, and possibly, you know, techniques, but I think, you know, strawberry growing, there's a publication, again, I don't want to always refer back to our extension publications, but there's a really nice one called Growing Strawberries in Wisconsin. And again, Growing Strawberries in Wisconsin, UWEX on the search box or going to the learning store will bring that publication up. And it kind of walks through all the different steps in establishment of a new planting in particular. But as far as the picking of the flowers, yes, that's still a standard recommendation on new plugs or new transplants that go in the spring is as they develop, you want to pick those flowers off to keep the energy going into the crown and into that mother plant so it can make those daughter plants and get all that plant material established for the following year, because that's when we really benefit from our planting is in the second year, and those flowers are being developed, you know, in mid and late summer, so for the following year. So picking those flowers off is definitely recommended. As far as the critters, you know, that's always our challenge when we garden is how much do we want to share with our neighbors and, you know, mice and chipmunks and four-line grunts.
Zero.
Yeah, zero.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, you have to consider, you know, what methods do you do to exclude, you know, the mice and the rabbits and everything else. So, you know, that's where the fencing comes in. But mulch, you know, we always recommend mulching the berries, especially going into the fall, because we want to protect the crowns of those plants from, you know, experiencing any frost damage over the winter. And, you know, it's called renovation, and, you know, you might actually mow off the top of the strawberry plant late in the summer and then mulch it and get it ready for the winter. So that's a technique that's often done on you know, strawberry plants. And, you know, the mulch and attracting critters, yeah, that's always going to be the challenge, because that's now a nice home for them to
right.
You know, yeah. So, boy, I don't know if there's an easy solution to that, especially if you have a high population of, you know,
yeah.
of mice and voles.
Okay, well, I was hoping you'd have different answers, but I figured it was going to be the same old. Yeah, I'm surrounded by DNR land, so the deer and every critter around gets just about on my garden, but I will keep on trying.
Thanks a lot for calling, Pam. Appreciate your call. Kevin Shesho, our guest today, Area Ag Development Agent for UW Extension. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. I'm really happy to have you along today as we visit with UW Extension expert Kevin Shesho. He's he does a wonderful job. He's an Area Ag Development Agent in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Special interest in soil ecology and composting, but as you can tell if you've been listening, he's got answers for a whole pile of things, and that's why it's so much fun to have him with us. If you have a question, all our lines are filled right now, but the number is 800-642-1234. You can always go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post a question or comment there, or email at talk@wpr.org. We had Carol in Cedar Grove, I believe, up next. Carol, hi.
Hi. My question is, I have a tomato plant, and it has a little black hole in it, and it's dying above that. And from that hole, I've seen, I'd say 3 to 5 little protrusions, white protrusions, like eggs on the stalk. And I was wondering if you could could let me know what I was supposed to do with it.
Now, the black hole, is a black hole in the leaves?
No, it's just in the stalk.
Oh.
It's like something bored into the stalk and went up.
Oh, okay.
Dead.
Well, yeah, there are borers, you know, cane borers, stalk borers, any number of those that do those kinds of things with our plants. And
again,
you've got evidence there, you know,
yeah.
Crime scene.
Yeah.
And, you know, that tells us something that's very likely an insect. And I'm not, at the top of my head, nothing specific comes to mind on tomatoes. You know, we know we've got vine borers that are quite common in our vine crops, and there's, you know, iris borers, and there's borers that get into our cherries and some of our fruit trees. But on tomatoes, I'm not as familiar with, you know, a common one, but that's certainly, you know, something that, you know, could have happened. Unfortunately, depending on how much damage there is, that's a pretty severe injury to that stem, I'm assuming. And
yeah,
it's just
it's
a matter.
Dead.
Yeah, if it's everything above that injury is probably going to wilt, and that part of the plant is probably done. But you know, if it's high enough up, you know, as most people know, tomatoes will send up suckers and side sprouts, and you know, so from the base of that plant, you should get some regrowth. So I wouldn't be quite ready to rogue that plant out. There's still enough time in the growing season to still benefit from what that plant can do for you. Might just be a single incident that, you know, isn't going to be, you know, detrimental to the rest of the plants.
Well, okay.
Three to five little white, you know, I'm assuming, but again, without, you know, having a picture or looking at that a little closer, you know, it sounds like it could be, you know, some eggs that were laid by something. Mm-hmm. There are funguses and other, you know, pathogens that can leave fruiting bodies that might look like an egg. But that's where, you know, if you have a hand lens or if you, you know, can look at it really close up, you might learn a little bit more about what those structures are. I'm never afraid to just wipe those things off and squish them or, you know, get rid of them. It's like, okay, they're probably not good for the plant anyways. And just see if the plant can kind of come back from this attack. Damage has been done. Probably can't do much about it at this point, other than, like I said, do that follow-up CSI work and, you know, try to keep that plant as healthy and happy as you can, given what it's been through.
And thanks again, Carol, for calling. Appreciate it. And Larry in Webster, Wisconsin, it's your turn. Hi, Larry. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. The last couple of years, I've noticed an increasing infestation in our asparagus, and it's an asparagus beetle. And so I was looking for a remedy for that would be earth-friendly and non-chemical. And I tried, based on some reading on the Internet, I tried applying beneficial nematodes to the soil. And it seems like it's been very helpful. I wondered if Kevin could comment on the use of nematodes and if he could give me an indication of how long I can expect to see their benefit in the soil and if I need to reapply.
Mm. Yeah, this is, you know, a really specialized type of a control method, and there are, you know, kind of biologicals that are effective in managing some of our pests, and nematodes are certainly one. Just like we have predatory, parasitic kind of insects that we can release into the environment, and they go out and hopefully, you know, chew on and destroy some of our unwanted pests, and nematodes, they're part of that soil food web that is part of that soil ecology. And for the most part, nematodes are beneficial, and they're all kinds of predatory ones. Some eat fungus, some eat bacteria, others are decomposers, and in some cases they can, eat larger, critters. And I don't know enough about this particular species of nematodes and how they work, but, you know, there are some that can crawl up onto the plant and, be beneficial. But as far as, you know, this specific one, I'm not familiar with it. I always encourage people to do their due diligence and read up on these things. And if they claim it's supposed to work on this particular pest, and it seems to be working, I would say, you know, good for you. And how long they're going to last in the soil, you know, it all gets back to that ecology that and that environment that this critter's got to live in. And, you know, there may be other nematodes and other critters in the soil that want to eat this thing too. So, you know, it may have a sustaining population and want to continue on, but it may not either, you know, depending on if it's got all the right, you know, environmental characteristics. So,
yep, there we go.
So there you are. Just, you know, if it works, great. I, you know, again, this is one that I don't know a lot about, but, you know, it sounds like you did some research and it seems to be working, so.
Good for you, Larry. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Bill in West Salem. Hi, we're on to you now. Thanks for calling.
Hey, hello, Larry and Kevin. I'm a frequent caller, Larry, and this one here is about apple trees. And do you handle apple trees, Kevin?
Sure.
All right. Yeah. I've got three apple trees, 5 years plus old, one Cortland, two Honeycrisp. The Cortland has blossomed. The Honeycrisp has not. Mm-hmm. The Cortlands have marble-sized apples 2 years in a row, full of wormhole scabs, da-da-da-da-da. I did use dormant oil in the spring. I have yet to use any pesticide or herbicide. I'm trying to stay away from that. Anyway, any suggestions, sure, sir?
Well, yeah, apples are probably one of our favorite fruits to grow in the backyard, and I enjoy them myself, and sometimes we are successful and sometimes we are more challenged. And it sounds like in this case you've got some issues, especially on the Cortland. You know, on a young tree, you know, we always have to keep in mind juvenility or how young that tree is and when it's going to bear fruit. So some trees will bear fruit a little sooner than others. So, you know, a five-year-old tree should start to be, you know, fruitful, especially if it's a dwarf or semi-dwarf. So that kind of addresses that fruitfulness issue. When we start seeing issues on the fruit, so you said marble-sized, so they never get any bigger than that? Or?
Well, last year, actually, they did get bigger. They were about, golf ball size.
Okay, yeah.
They're on their way up.
Those are a nice big fruit. I mean, they should be much bigger than that at the end of the season. So that's an indication that those fruit are not getting the nutrition they need, you know, to fully develop. You know, are the tips, the new growth that comes off of that tree, does it seem to, you know, this year's growth, how long is it right now? Is it, you know, half inch, you know, 2 inches long?
Yeah, they're a couple inches, yeah.
I mean, that's
done. Yeah.
We always look at the tips of the new growth to, you know, give a general indication of the fruit, the tree's nutrients and, you know, if there's enough food for that. So, you know, if we're seeing the growth on the shoot tips, there should be adequate nutrients there to develop the fruit. You know, unless there's too many, I mean, sometimes thinning a tree, is it loaded with fruit or
no,
is it not overly loaded?
Nope. These are dwarf apple trees, sir.
Yeah, so they should. Boy, I guess, you know, there could be some environmental factors going there. If it, you know, again, I'm assuming it's in full sun, and it's not getting too many other microclimate influences with cold temperatures or excess humidity. Or
would you soil test that?
Well, you know, I guess, you know, we always fall back on that as a good thing to do, just to verify, you know, that baseline information. You know, any other evidence there that we could draw from that might,
well,
you know?
I have to admit, it's out in a wooded area. I've got all the trees within 30 to 40 feet cleared away, so it's a clearing. But is there something in the trees that are attacking it? I don't know.
Yeah, again, you know, if the fruits look blemished and if you said they're full of wormholes and there's railroad tracks in there, railroad worms or any number of, you know, insect pests, I mean, that's also an indication that, you know, there's that to contend with, too. You know, apple fly maggot is our most common insect pest on apples. You know, coddling moth. You know, and we have to try to minimize that impact of both of those pests. And you know, you can put in the sticky red spheres as a way to kind of attract and trap some of those adults as they fly around the trees. They're not going to get all of them. You know, that's kind of an organic or non-chemical way to deal with fruit pests. But it could be that you're just placing those trees in a unique enough environment, and there's lots of other factors that are keeping those trees from being healthy and happy.
Might have to look for a different spot, Bill.
Yeah, we could, you know, go online, growing apples in Wisconsin. I'd start there and just see if there's some changes you can make to that environment to improve that microclimate. And, you know, maybe there is some nutrition things going on, or maybe it's just a bad spot.
And thanks a lot for calling, Bill. Appreciate it. Mike sent us a photo on our Facebook page of some tulips from last year, bright red and bright yellow. This year, the tulips came up and they were all white. What the heck happened there? That's a new one on me.
So the flowers themselves were white.
Yes, apparently.
So they reverted back to some ancestral gene, maybe. I don't know. I know viruses will cause, you know, color streaking and some pretty funky things with plant colors and flower colors.
But this is one that we might not have an answer for this. I would love to have a photo
of this year's white flowers. Yeah,
send us a photo of this year's white flowers. That's what I want to see for sure. And that would help us out a lot. Kevin Shesho, our guest today. He is the Area Ag Development Agent for the University of Wisconsin Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties, and does a wonderful job for us on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Friday means Garden Talk, and today we're visiting with one of the great UW Extension horticulture and ag agents, Larry Mueller, here with my guest Kevin Shesho, who works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties for UW Extension. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening in today. He's actually in our studios, our Superior studios, so wonderful to have him along, and really appreciate your questions as well when we visit with him about pretty much everything relating to the garden and the soil in the garden. So join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And Kevin, with lots of callers, lots of email and Facebook questions, we had a question from Molly in Mequon, so I think we'll go there next. Molly, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a 20-year-old clay soil raised bed organic garden. I've amended it through the years with my own compost and commercial composted manure. I typically cover it in the winter with about 2 inches of either cedar droppings or leaves or straw. I quit turning it over in the fall several years ago because of the incredible weed competition. That hasn't helped. I still have incredible weed competition, even though I do mulch the garden after it's planted. We've certainly been probably guilty of working at it when it was still a bit wet, although really haven't done that recently, I don't think. But it is dry, cracked. It's the worst soil I've ever seen. And I've never tried cover crop through the winter or the fall or anything like that. So I'm just wondering, what am I doing wrong?
How big is this bed?
It's about 20 by 8.
Okay. And does it have wood sides or structures on the side, or is it just kind of a mounded raised bed?
No, cedar raised bed.
Okay. So it's a kind of a boxed raised bed.
Correct. Yeah, two 4 foot by 20 sections.
Right. So you're... your biggest concern right now is, well, you mentioned that, you know, weeds are, you know, incredible weed growth, you know, when you do disturb it. And that's fairly common with just most any soil because you're exposing those seeds to the sun and giving them a chance to germinate. And that's just how it is with a seed bank that's probably built up over the years. And but the other concern is just the what we would call the soil tilth and the physical characteristics of that soil are getting kind of hard and cracked and caked. And is that probably your biggest concern right now?
Absolutely. All this work and then the soil is yet cracked.
Yeah.
Yeah. And when you've incorporated these organic materials, have you tried to work them in? I'm assuming, you know, 20 years, that's a long time. You should have.
Boy, you should have great soil.
Especially if you're adding lots of organic matter. I mean, that's one of our primary, you know, additives to improving just about any soil is to, you know, add those organic compounds to the soil. One of our challenges, though, once we, you know, we have it in a confined space like that, it can become compacted over time, especially, you know, those heavier clay soils, and they're more prone to that compaction. And, you know, I'm assuming you're not walking on it because it's a big enough space, or you can avoid some of that.
Correct.
Yeah, I would, I guess you have two options. You can, you know, I would continue to encourage adding those organic materials. You know, one caution, though, is we can add too much, you know, and that's, you have to let your plants tell you whether you're adding too much organic material, especially if it's a high nitrogen type organic material. But if it's a composted, you know, material or leaf mold or, you know, something that's not really rich and high in nitrogen, that should be a good thing to loosen up that soil over time and make it so it isn't so compacted. And it may come, you know, sometimes we have to replace some of that soil with something different. That's always an option. I know it's a lot of work to dig up that volume of soil and replace it. Then you got to figure, well, what do I replace it with? So you could do that on a portion of the bed. Just say, okay, I'm going to renovate, as in scoop out some of this existing soil and then blend in as much you know, organic material and really try to, you know, renovate it from the bottom of the box all the way to the top with some, you know, some new materials, and see if that doesn't help, you know, bring some of that soil structure and tilth back into the.
Do you think I should? I won't take out, but maybe I could add more. Shall I turn this over? I mean, it is so dry and cracked. I can't. I mean, I've got the garden planted and.
Do you water the garden, or?
You know, I do try to water it once a week, but if this is Mequon, it's been pretty good with the with the rain. But even if I didn't water it, you know, it's covered, it's mulched. You would think it would. I was worried that I was putting too much mulch on it over the winter without turning it over, and that the moisture wasn't getting through.
Well, we certainly want to try to get that organic matter incorporated. You know, forking and you know, trying to do it physically is fine. I mean, one of our challenges is if we go in there and we really work it hard, say like with a small tiller, and you're breaking up those clods, you know, you're making it so it's a finer texture, and that might cause it to stay compact. But certainly if we can incorporate those with, you know, some kind of, you know, shovel or fork, that would probably be beneficial rather than just leaving it always sit on the top. I don't know, do you notice, is there any kind of worm activity in this bed or other kinds of evidence?
I don't have near as many worms there as I have elsewhere, but I've got good beneficial. I've got worms. I've got good beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
I got lots of snakes. Not that that helps the soil, but
I would try to be more deliberate in incorporating some of that organic material into the soil, and perhaps, you know, you just do a part of it, or you let part of it rest and be intentional about planting a cover crop, you know, buckwheat or annual rye or an annual grass like oats or barley, sweet clover. Just do that on a small portion of it and let those roots work their way down in the soil. And because it's an annual plant, they'll die over the winter, and all those roots will open up some of those channels, and maybe that'll help loosen up the soil a little bit, too.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Good luck, Molly. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Mary has a question from Oshkosh for you, Kevin, so let's go to her. Mary, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling actually for my sister-in-law. She's concerned about an area of soil that's under a garage window where she has some strawberries planted. And earlier this spring, her husband and father-in-law repainted the window and they scraped. And so she's wondering about lead in the soil. She doesn't know if there was lead in that paint, if the soil test would tell her that, or if there's some other way to know.
Yeah, very good question, and you're right to be concerned. You know, if it's an older house and, you know, the paint that was originally put on there was a lead-containing paint, then you've really got a legitimate concern there. And, you know, that's just the reality of some of our practices, and we know that these things are out in the environment. A standard routine soil test doesn't test specifically for heavy metals or other contaminants outside of the standard, you know, nutrients that we know plants need, like, you know, nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium, some of our micronutrients. But you can request a test specific for lead. And if you go on the soil testing website, it's Marshfield is where we have our main soil testing lab now. And on there will be an information sheet on, you know, selecting what you want analyzed. So that would be a place to look. And you can, you know, collect the soil sample, make sure it's representative of the area you want the information on, and then submit the form and specifically mention that you want this tested for lead. And then they would, you know, do that specific test.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's something to be concerned about, definitely. Yep. You know, especially if, again, the evidence points to there being lead in that paint, you know, be the safest thing to do.
Yep, and if it's an old house and, you know, it's, and it was likely that that early paint would have been lead, had lead in it, for sure. Andy in Harpers Ferry, Iowa. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey there. Got a question about the service berries. This year we had a marvelous crop. We have two or three sites of them. We got them through the DNR or the Forest Division in Iowa. I don't remember which. But they are they edible? Are they safe? Or are they just bitter and good-looking? The birds always took care of them, but this year they came up late, they blossomed late, and they were the hugest, dime-sized berries.
Wow. I'm drawing a blank on common names versus the Latin names, but Amelanchier, you know, Juneberry, I think Serviceberry is another common name for it. You know, if it is an Amelanchier, those are certainly edible, you know, June berries. They come in, you know, early on in the season, and often they're on, you know, small shrubs or shrubs or small tree size associated with wetlands or rivers and that kind of thing. So I would think if that's what you got there, they should be edible.
Oh, yeah.
Late for them. Most of them are done, you know, fruiting, and the fruits have either been eaten by birds or dropped by this time of year, and if I'm thinking correctly here. But I would say if they are Amelanchier, they should be edible.
And thanks for calling, Andy. Appreciate it. Jim and Pence, well, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Last fall, I went to Traverse City to visit family, and in the backyard, there were, you still there?
Yep.
Okay. There were three huge mulberry bushes loaded with berries. Wisconsin? And if I can, how do I go about it? Because I've heard two different things. I heard they can be grown in Zone 4, and then other nurseries have said, no, they can't. It has to be Zone 6, and I'm in Zone 4. What can I do?
Yeah, you're right to question, you know, zone hardiness, because what grows in Travis City is, you know, not going to necessarily do well, up in central Wisconsin, say. So zone hardiness is certainly something we got to take into consideration. Mulberries, I know, grow in Wisconsin. I've seen them personally, you know, more in the southeastern part of the state, and that's more of a zone 5. But when you're selecting a landscape plant, that's the first thing that we have to take into consideration is that zone hardiness. So when you're looking to purchase or bring in a mulberry plant, just keep that in mind. And if it says it's suitable for zone 3 or zone 4, I think you should be fine. And, you know, again, without looking things up and being a little more specific about, you know, certain varieties, I'm only giving a general, you know, recommendation here.
Mm-hmm. And you might, you might just go to your local, if you got a local business, horticulture business that sells plants, that might be.
Well, I did do that, and they said that their supplier will not ship them up here.
Huh?
But yet there's another supplier that said they will because they were zone 4, and the local supplier said no, they won't do it because they're zone 6.
Well, if you want to give it a try, you can give it a try with the...
I don't want to waste my time.
Yeah.
Well, with a little research, and I'm sure the information to help you make a decision on what to do here is out there. It's just, do you have the patience, and is it really worth it in the end? And, you know, in this case, maybe you just say, well, maybe I'll try something that I feel more confident with.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Jim. Appreciate it. We had question on our Facebook page posted from Carol, who says, would you please ask your guest about my broccoli plants? Now, she's in one of your counties. She's in Washburn County, Kevin. And she says she's got these huge, beautiful broccoli plants, but no broccoli.
No flowers on the broccoli.
They should be producing by now, she says.
The broccoli I planted is getting pretty tall and spindly, and I've been wondering the same question. Environment, you know, we have to make sure it's in full sun and it's not getting too much nutrients, too rich a soil, because if it's, you know, getting too much nitrogen, for instance, it will tend to want to grow tall and spindly and not necessarily set flower. So that, without knowing a little bit more about the environment that plant is in, that would be something I would question. Is it in a nice full sun location, and you know, is it over-fertilized? That might be a reason for it not going to flower. That would be the two things that come to my mind is why it's not flowering, unless it just needs a little bit more time. But if it's in a nice, tall, healthy plant, we should start seeing that flower head developing. That would be my comment, at least without knowing more, you know, or having a picture, that kind of thing.
Annie in Watertown, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I was looking at aronia berries, choke cherries, and my friend has them, and they're really very prickly bushes. Are all varieties such prickly bushes?
Aronia, okay.
Chokeberry.
Yeah. We do have two aronia bushes growing in our teaching and display garden at the research station, and they're doing quite well, actually. I think it's a Viking is the name of that variety. I'm trying to think, does that thing have a lot of spines, and is it, you know, pokey like that? You know, I know gooseberries are, you know, notorious for that. But I guess I'm not 100% sure on aronia. I mean, I imagine there could be different varieties that are you know, have those thorns on them. But off the top of my head, I guess I don't know that.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful plant. It's very hardy. It's zone 2. It's gotten a lot of attention recently as one of those minor fruits, and they're trying to commercialize that more and more because it's so well suited for our climate here. But I don't know about the spines.
They're got a call from Randy from Sauk County, who said, this is to the previous caller who had the hard soil, said there may be sand within the mulch. She's, you know, the sand makes the soil hard as cement or concrete. She can dilute it with high-quality potting soil.
Well, that's a very good point that, you know, we really need to visit is, you know, because everybody knows about, you know, sand, silt, and clay and how they can develop a nice loamy soil. And if you have a clay soil, oh, all we got to do is add a little sand and get it to be more loamy. Well, there's such a contrast in particle size between the, you know, that huge sand particle and those tiny plate-like clay particles that you end up making cement. So I guess that's the question that I didn't ask that caller is, you know, what is the quality of that compost? And, you know, if for some reason you are bringing in sand with that mulch, depending on, again, the source and the quality of it, yeah, that could definitely be a concern. We don't want to add sand to clay. I'd much rather just get a good quality source of organic matter to work in. So, yeah, that was a very good point that Randy made.
Carrie sent us a note about on Facebook who had a beautiful, healthy trumpet vine without a single bud, wondering what she did wrong.
Yeah, flowers and vines, it's not quite my area of expertise, not like some of my colleagues, but I'm trying to think, anytime we don't see flowers, you know, you got to think about, you know, what's causing that and, you know, environment, you know, we talked about that with the apple tree and, you know, with the broccoli, you know, being in full sun. So there's certain environmental conditions that have to happen. You know, frost might take out those flower buds. You know, there's any number of factors that might, you know, prevent a plant from setting flowers, especially if it did it one year and not the next. So I guess, you know, I'd have to kind of
take a
pass on this
one
a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not 100% sure there, you know, without, you know, having more information.
I've got a problem with one of my own, too. My trumpet vine was looking great, flowers one day and, like, maybe a day or maybe it was 2 days. I don't remember. I took a look at it and it's dead. What the heck happened? You know, so I'm also worried or wondering. I guess I'm not worried anymore. It's nothing much to worry about anymore because it's gone. It's one of those mysteries that, you know, what the heck? Because my neighbor doesn't, I don't think, used any chemicals or anything. It was like one of those, it died so fast, it was almost like it had gotten a whiff of some sort of chemical. But
Well, that's at Horticulture CSI, and sometimes the evidence isn't very clear, and it is kind of a mystery.
Well, Kevin, this is always a pleasure to have you with us. I really enjoyed talking with you today, and I'm hoping that we can get together and do this again.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Larry, and I love my drive up here to beautiful Superior. And just a little side comment that when I was driving up on Highway 2, when we were mentioning, you know, the person with the chickens, it just reflected back on, you know, everybody's doing this local food thing, and backyard chickens are pretty common. And a fox ran right across the highway and never guessed what it had in its mouth.
Oh, a chicken.
Somebody's chicken. So
there you go.
Local food for the local fox, I guess.
Oh, man. Kevin, thank you so much. Thanks again. Kevin Sheshel, Area Development Ag Agent for UW Extension with Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn Counties. Watching a fox with a chicken in its mouth run across the road on Highway 2 in northern Wisconsin. Oh, man, well, I can picture it. I can picture it. Maybe you can, too. And stay listening. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.